directional. Chantal Ryan and Jörg Tittel.
How is everybody doing today?
Who's great. Doing badly? Raise your hand. Good. Okay, so what's wrong?
Oh, God. Oh. Oh, thanks, man. I've got one fan. I've never had a fan.
You can lose him in the next 55 minutes.
Well, no, thank you very much. This is my warm-up technique. Yeah,
we're now recording, apparently. We're good.
Oh, amazing.
Go ahead.
So, Chantal, here we are again, aren't we?
Here we are again.
Directional. A show about video games and the creative rebellion.
Show about nothing.
Well, technically, video games are mostly about nothing, and therefore the rebellion doesn't exist.
You make an excellent point.
But so we had to bring someone in who comes from a sector of the game industry, so to speak, that is even less about something than the games that are already about nothing. And therefore, what does it make that sector of the industry? Here is the less than zero, Aaron Loeb. Welcome.
Well, that is the warmest welcome I've ever received. Thank you. You've wrapped all the way around from, you know, kind to horrible back to kind. That's really nice. Thank you.
You're very welcome. That's what we're here for. Chantal, we've been talking about video games a lot. We've been talking about the world a lot. And we also, because we are maniacs, have been talking about potentially wanting to make a mobile game one day.
Maniacs, correct.
Mm-hmm. So we love mobile games, don't we?
No, we don't. I think that we should first begin by explaining what the hell Directional is, why we're here, and who the hell this guy is.
Shall we? Okay. Well, do you want to talk about what Directional is?
Directional. This is actually our first live episode. Welcome, and thank you, everybody. We are here to essentially interrogate the video games industry, talk about why the hell it's so often about nothing and maybe what we can do about it. We have many illustrious guests from all sorts of creative spaces, not just game designers and publishers, but also we interview artists and musicians and poets and all sorts of interesting people with interesting creative ideas and backgrounds. And then we have this guy.
Yeah, what's really exciting is like we've taken you all in this room here in Dubrovnik. We're at the Reboot Develop Blue conference in beautiful, beautiful Dubrovnik in Croatia. And all the people in this room are in a time machine, because this episode that we're currently recording will come out much later than the already 8 episodes that we've already recorded in the past or your future, depending of how you think about it. And therefore, here's a man from the future, Aaron Loeb, because he literally is actually ahead of all of us in terms of numbers, because he's reaching 3 billion people on this planet with his work. And Aaron is a dear friend, and he has just left Scopely. Tell us about Scopely. What were you doing there? What were you doing at Scopely?
Sure. So hello, everyone. My name's Aaron Loeb. I've been in the games industry for about 30 years. I started in the paper and pencil role-playing game industry, designing things like Dungeons & Dragons, not actually Dungeons & Dragons, but things like it. Designed some award-winning stuff in the third edition era as well. About 25 years ago, I was a journalist in the games industry, which is where I first met Jörg here. And at the turn of the century, I decided to start making games 23 years ago. And I worked at a company called Planet Moon Studios, which was a PC and console game studio. It made Giants, Citizen Kabuto, if anybody remembers that. It was the team that originally made MDK, a bunch of great classic games that made no money and got good reviews. And then continued on into the Wii era, where we learned that we could make money without getting good reviews. And ultimately, around 12 years ago, I decided to move into the free-to-play space quite eagerly, very happily, in fact. And that's one of the things I'd love to talk about. And started making Facebook games, but then ultimately pretty quickly moved into mobile free-to-play, where first starting at EA, or Electronic Arts, where I was the general manager of The Simpsons Tapped Out, then moving over to Kabam, where I launched Marvel Contest of Champions, then Fox Next Games, which I built from the ground up, and we launched Marvel Strike Force, and then ultimately Scopely. Now, that journey, by the way, Kabam, Fox Next, Scopely involved being acquired each time. So we sold Kabam and were acquired by Fox, and then Disney acquired Fox, and then Scopely acquired the Fox Next Games assets. So I've been through many acquisitions, and now Scopely has just announced that it's being acquired by a company called Savvy Games. And I, you know, this will be my fifth acquisition in 6 years, and ultimately I've decided I need to take some time off. So I'm actually
all that getting quiet is so tiring.
It is actually quite tiring. So I am going on a sabbatical for a while, and I'm thinking about what I want to do next, and thinking about the state of the industry and the state of me, and what I want to do in the industry next. So you find me at that moment.
Interestingly, Aaron has very cleverly left out another dark past of his, is that he actually is also, shudder that thought, an artist, actually. He's actually a playwright. He's pretending to just be a sort of cold-hearted, money-grubbing businessman.
Corporate Boston.
But he is actually a brilliant playwright. And you were talking about reviews earlier. That was interesting. So you basically went into mobile. Tell me about that.
Yeah. All right. Yes. So thank you, Jörg. Yes. Simultaneously to building up my career in video games over the last 23 years, I was also writing plays. That's actually where I started my formal education, is as a playwright. About 23 years ago, I started working with some theater companies in the Bay Area and got to be known as a playwright there. Back in 2012, I think I had my first play go off Broadway, and I've had a few plays go off Broadway and be performed around the world. My best known play is called Ideation, which is a play about a group of management consultants who you learn have been hired to design a concentration camp. And over time, you're wondering, well, why are they designing this concentration camp? And you see them working at this quite diligently. Are they terrible people? What's this? And then you realize, oh, they think they're doing it for good reasons, but then they start questioning, why are we designing this concentration camp? So that's my best known play, and I've been working as a playwright sort of parallel to making video games.
Is that exactly how the board meetings at mobile game companies go as well?
Well, I will confess to you that that play was bored of two things. One, my wife is an international human rights attorney, and she at that time was pursuing those who committed atrocity crimes and taking them to court. And so I was listening to her practice her opening statement in a trial against the, it doesn't matter who, but a very bad guy who killed a lot of people in Somaliland, in the sort of genocide in Somalia. And I heard her sort of describing the way they'd systemically destroyed the people of Somaliland. I'm not going to get into the history of Somalia, but it's the former British colony of Somalia, and the rest is the former Italian colony of Somalia. And so they systemically, you know, first they got rid of the intellectuals, then they purged the army, and then they ultimately started carpet bombing cities, etc. Further and further got rid of those who could resist them. And I thought they, you know, I was hearing this sort of very pedestrian and clear design of how they went step by step to do this. And meanwhile, I was working at that moment in the games industry, and this is worth talking about, as free-to-play was happening, there was a really interesting opportunity to go direct to consumers. As a creative person, I was really excited to be disintermediated and actually make games that I could just go straight to the player, not have to see what my Metacritic was, hear from the player, change the game, move faster, because I felt like the system we were in as game makers was totally broken. You'd work for 3 years to try to make something, you'd release it, somebody at, you know, gameschmuck.org.net had had a bad day that day, gave you a 4 out of 10, and now not only is nobody buying the game, you've got this bad Metacritic, but you're actually seeing the careers of your colleagues who you've put through this journey actually hurt, because now they're carrying their, well, my last game was a 7 out of 10, and et cetera. And so I wanted to get out of that particular thing. So I was very excited about that. But the interesting thing is, because we're going to direct consumer, there was also this business opportunity, right? And so a bunch of people who had nothing to do with games, had never made a game, weren't particularly interested in games, started flooding into the games industry as well. And a lot of those people were former management consultants. And so I found myself in meetings often, working with management consultants, kind of deconstructing the problem of making a video game in the language of management consulting, which I, because I'm me and a nerd, found intoxicating. I loved hearing the way in which they break down every structure into its component parts. One day I was driving to work and those two ideas just merged, and I thought about, well, yeah, management consultants would have done a great job for them in Somalia, and that was how the play was born. Sorry, I've gotten maybe a little far afield.
Wow, yeah, no, that's, and also the other thing, and before Chantal, oh, she will start in a minute. I'm scared, actually, because you're my friend, Aaron, and I'm just very worried for you.
I'll be okay.
Well, we'll see. Challenge Chantal too much. But no, the review thing in theater is gutting as well, isn't it? Did you have experiences with that as well?
Yeah, so my first play to go off Broadway had this sort of enchanted career. It was first done in San Francisco and got, you know, sold out every show, and then went to the New York Fringe Festival and sold out the shows before it even opened and got incredible reviews. And so we decided to take it off Broadway, and the critics of New York teed up on it, and it just got destroyed when we went off Broadway. It was a play called Abraham Lincoln's Big Gay Dance Party, and it was a play about a teacher in a small town elementary school who decides to teach her students that Abraham Lincoln was gay and gets prosecuted for having done that. And I'm telling you this because this was over 10 years ago, and the critics said, that is ridiculous. That is an absurd premise that would never happen in America. And of course, in the last 2 years, we've had the rise of Don't Say Gay bills where exactly that thing is happening. So am I bitter about that? Yes, I'm extremely bitter about that. But yes, that was an experience that you could work for years. You could have all these people putting their hearts and souls into making this theater production, and then the New York Times doesn't like you, and that's it. It's over. And similarly, you're dead, right? But then my next play went off Broadway, and it was Ideation, and it got a very nice, it got a Critics' Choice review, and of course, then I loved it. Then the critics are great, right? And so, you know, like, you've got this terrible ride that you have to ride if you're going to be in that business. Now, go ahead, Chantal.
Damn. Sir, you were kind of writing this playwright Johnny at the same time you're writing this kind of like early mobile games Johnny, and you're navigating these realms of art, industry, business, creativity, and you're kind of mixing them all together. So I would love to hear a little bit more about your journey from being a game maker to somebody who kind of rose to the top of this fairly large company, as someone who was kind of directing the business, if I'm correct. Can you tell us more about what your role was as, was it chief business officer?
Yes, I was chief business officer.
Yeah, can you explain like what a chief business officer does?
Yes, I can explain what a chief business officer is usually, and I can explain what a chief business officer officer was at Scopely. So.
Oh, how about both?
Yeah. So chief business officer is often the same title or similar title of chief operating officer. And the chief business officer is responsible for the running of the business. So that's in most companies. This was not my role at Scopely. At Scopely, I was responsible for the product pipeline, basically, and the systems of the product pipeline. So the so most companies have a game development framework. So how do you decide when to fund games, when to move them forward, when to move them back, et cetera. So I rebuilt the company's entire system of development with my team. But then we also had a live services framework. So how we operate the games, how we measure them, what we think success is. And so a lot of my work in the past years has been overhauling the way we think of and measure free-to-play games, which I can talk to at any amount of depth that you would like. But basically, most free-to-play games since the early days are measured by most people who make them through daily revenue and simple metrics like day one retention or day 30 retention. And these metrics are not only bad, they often lead the people who make the games into wildly self-destructive behaviors, where they chase those numbers and blow up their game by blowing up their community and actually ruin the entire business. And there's many, many examples one can track of that. So the core insight that I brought to Scopely from all the work at Kabam and Fox Next and overhauled about the company's pipeline put most basically, your game is driven by making sure that people love it and that they are rewarded for wanting to engage with it really deeply rather than making it so they have to pay you money in order to enjoy your game, right? And that's actually measurable and improvable, et cetera, and so that's a big part of the work. In the last year, I was primarily focused on Scopely's new pipeline, so games in development moving forward and what we were investing in and what we were acquiring, so the future product pipeline for Scopely. And a big part, sort of the overlying thesis of what I was doing at Scopely was, Scopely when I joined was mostly an external development company. It worked with partner studios. We didn't like the term external development because it sounded like it was like, we're gonna pay you and you go make something. It was always deep partnership and development, but it was with partner developers. And over this past few years, the company's become much more internal studio focused. And so working with the CEOs to build a great internal studio system.
Interesting. So how did you kind of feel about this move from somebody more in that artistic space to being more maybe on the production, the management, the potentially money end?
And the pipeline burning. I mean, he became an oil like mogul, essentially, right? Because you talk about pipelines a lot.
Baron Aaron is what we call him.
I made one game in my career where I was credited, one video game in my career where I was credited as lead designer. It was a game called Smarty Pants for the Wii. I was very proud of that game, actually. It was really quite fun. And the reason why I only have one game where I was credited as lead designer is because I've had the opportunity to work with really very good designers. And they're better than I am.
Respect.
And so over my career, I've learned that there's people who are better producers than me. There's people who are better artists than me. There are people who are better designers than me. But I found that where my talent was bringing it together and basically speaking the language of business to creative people and the language of creative to business people and making sure that essentially the creative vision of a team was not being ruined by the business not understanding what they were doing, which I don't know if anybody has ever experienced that in video games, but it's very common, and making sure that the creative people understood how they were being measured, what the needs were of both the business and the market in order to be able to succeed. And so in our business, we don't really have a name for that. And in what I learned when I went to Fox and was in Hollywood was that's called a creative executive, right? That is what, those are the people who run it. And I learned a ton by being at Fox about the being a creative executive. Peter Rice, who ran Fox Television, would always say, we don't make the movies. Like, we don't make the TV shows. I hate that when people say that. Like, we're all very proud of it, of course, but we didn't make Avatar. James Cameron made Avatar, right? Our job was to give him money. Our job was to market it. Our job was to make it happen. But we're here to support the creator. We're here to actually help them make what they're trying to make. And I think what I, you know, I've learned over the years in the video game industry, certainly early in my career, we thought it was the, you know, the marketing team or the publishing team was the real organizing intelligence. They were figuring out how to get the thing in this, you know, get the thing onto the end cap and go sell it, right? Obviously to me, it is the creative team, the people who are in the trenches doing the, you know, the blood, sweat, and tears of making the game. They are the creators. And the job of the business is to help them succeed, to remove any of their obstacles, to do whatever is necessary. John Landgraf, who runs the FX network, says, if one of my creators needs a foot rub, I'm giving them a foot rub, right? That's my job. My job is to make it happen for them so that they're able to succeed.
How many foot rubs have you given?
I find that foot rubs are probably workplace inappropriate, so I've actually never given a foot rub, but it was a good example from a John Landgraf speech.
what's interesting being here at the Reboot Develop Blue conference, which I consider to be the best video game conference in the world. It's the one where you have the most human exchanges. It's the one where you're the most likely to talk about games as culture. It's one where you will very rarely ever, you actually pointed out to me, ever have anyone talking about metrics and graphs and things like that. But you also will never hear about mobile games here.
Well, like, you do as a punchline.
That's true. Yes. You even have people who essentially work for mobile game companies like Meta talk about, like, yeah, at least we don't make mobile games. They're like, okay. So it's seen as a sort of bizarre sort of alternate reality that we have nothing to do with. Why do you think that is? And also, do you think this kind of strange separation also has allowed both mobile games to rise so quickly, perhaps even uncontrollably, and perhaps even without any sort of the sort of moral and other, you know, sort of indicators and sort of judgments that we are slowly but surely starting to have in the console and PC game business?
Okay, so those are two, maybe three, very complex questions. So and they're really good questions, so I want to dive into them. So first off, why did I get excited about mobile in the first place? Sometime, maybe it was in 2012 or so, I was in Peru. And I was in a town called Ollantaytambo, which I just like saying. Ollantaytambo. And Ollantaytambo was like the marketplace for the Inca, right? So the foot of a big temple. And there's been a marketplace where things have been sold for hundreds of years. Like, people come around to sell their stuff. And I was walking through the marketplace in Ollantaytambo, and somebody is desperately trying to call me on my cell phone, and I would like them to stop, and I don't know why that's happening. Okay, no, it's fine. As I was walking through the marketplace, I saw the, you know, if you've ever been to Peru, there's the Peruvian knitted caps that you see. And I saw a bunch of the knitted caps, and there were a lot of Monsters, Inc. characters with knitted caps, and there were Angry Birds. Right, and I start realizing that the impact on culture, you know, we talk about impact on culture as a thing that we talk about here in Reboot. Well, you know, when the descendants of the Inca are selling hats based on your characters, you've made an impact on culture. When that's reached every corner of the earth, you've made an impact on culture. And there was not a Master Chief hat, right? There was not a Metal Gear Solid hat. There was an Angry Birds hat, right? Because those characters have reached everyone. I realized, okay, here's this platform is going to be the place to reach the whole world. And then the next moment that really clicked for me was soon after that. My wife was in this sort of heavy. She was at a ceremony in Somaliland where they had sort of dug up a mass grave in one of their investigations. And the bodies that had been in the mass grave had been properly blessed by an imam, and they were now reburying them. And she was honored to be invited to the ceremony where they're reburying the bodies that had been discovered. And so she posted a picture of this on Facebook and said how honored she was to be here. And Kathy immediately got this just chain of 70 responses in Somali, just like this long chain of people responding on their cell phones in Somaliland. And so this is a country that's, you know, other than Afghanistan, was probably one of the most destroyed countries on the face of the planet. They did not have personal computers. Most people, you know, they don't have, they didn't have Ethernet. People don't have Xboxes there. Everyone had a cell phone. And since I've gotten a lot of chances to talk to Somali friends, and it's, you know, everybody has smartphones everywhere in Somalia. It's how people pay for things, et cetera. And this is true across all of Africa. It's true across all of India, right? More people, as I speak to you right now, have access to 3G on the face of the planet than running water. And that's been true for many, many years. And so, you know, what I recognized was we talk about games having an impact on human culture. And when we say that, we say, and we're going to have that impact on human culture by making games that you have to have a $500 console rigged to a, you know, $700 4G TV with your Sonos surround system to really fully experience. And that's going to have a huge impact on human culture. And that's, frankly, nonsense, right? The impact on human culture is on this device that has access to, you know, 3 billion people have smartphones. This is the way most, and by the way, most of the games that people are playing all the time have deep social connections where these people are talking to each other. They're playing together, right? One of my early experiences, I was in a guild in one of our games where one of the players was, or a couple of the players were former US Marines, and several of the other players were guys from Pakistan. And when it was Ramadan, the Marines all wished the guys from Pakistan, you know, Ramadan Mubarak, and the Pakistani guys were like, thank you, brothers. And they'd formed these people would never have met in real life, but they'd formed a deep friendship through this game. And because these devices are literally everywhere. And so that's a big part of why, you know, I got into this, and why, while I've loved this conference, I think it's interesting that not only, you know, it's just clear to me that people actually don't really know what's happening in mobile, right? So it remains a punchline. And it remains a punchline because mobile is synonymous with free-to-play. And free-to-play is synonymous with microtransactions. And microtransactions are generally understood by real game developers as evil. And I have a lot of thoughts on that. But, you know, when you say, you know, how you lack the moral, you know, checks and balances that perhaps our more elevated PC and console industry have. You know, when I think about what I do, I think I've, you know, I and the companies I've worked at, really, the teams I've worked for, basically, because let me be clear, like as Peter Rice said, I don't make anything. The teams made, the creators made these things. But the games that I've gotten a chance to work on have been given away for free to a billion people. And some percentage of those people spent money in them, yes, of course, and some people spent a lot of money in them, but the overwhelming majority of the people playing these games never spend anything, and we don't make them spend anything. And they continue to play, and they get free entertainment from these games, and I find that to be quite moral, rather than requiring people to give you $60 to get access to your genius, right? So that's how I think about it. That was a long, long answer.
It was a good answer. I'm very interested in your comment on how mobile games have such an impact on culture today, and not just general culture, but cultures across the world, individual cultures. I was reminded that traveling Europe, I was really struck by the fact that there's Fuzzy Wuzzy, or whatever he's called, from that horror game. I don't know if you guys have seen it, but across Greece, across Croatia, I was seeing this like strange horror game mascot hanging in convenience stores all around the place. It's fascinating. So you talk about morality and how it's moral to give entertainment to many, many people for free. And that pricing and money spending, it's all kind of optional. And I want to interrogate that a little bit.
It deserves interrogation. Please do.
So I guess I'd like to start by asking a little bit about your experiences with maybe the change in monetization over your experiences with the mobile games industry as it's evolved, and if you could talk a little bit more about the evolution of strategies of monetization.
I'd love to, thank you. And we didn't prep this, and that's such a great question to prep something that I would love to talk about. So in the early days of free-to-play, the belief for most people who are making free-to-play, but particularly the belief of business jerks like me, was that the way these games worked is you'd get people in the top of the funnel. So understand, when I say funnel, I mean you've got, say, 100 people install the game, and by day 30, only 10 people are still playing it, right? So understand that that's sort of shaped like a funnel. You come, players in the top, and then...
So are you shoving people into pipelines as well now?
Darren, yes. Aaron.
Yeah. Figurative pipelines. Yeah, yeah. Well, more meat grinders. Anyway, so there's this funnel of players, right? So people start, you know, a bunch of people install the game on day zero, right? And by day one, you've retained 30% of them, et cetera, et cetera. So this is how in the metrics of the business people talk about it. And so it was the belief that it was inevitable that your players would all leave you by, say, 6 months, right? 6 months in, they'd all be gone. And so it was considered the job of people making free-to-play games to extract revenue from them as fast as possible before they would churn. And you'd be in a room and there'd be people talking about revenue extraction, right? And there would be real...
The pipeline.
Unless you're a dentist, talking about extraction and your customers is, I think, not a great thing, right? And so it was absolutely the practice of the business to try to get money out as fast as possible. And this was thought to be a good practice, right? And what we all saw in 2012, about then, was that this little company in Finland released a game called Clash of Clans, and they did not aggressively extract revenue from their customers. And there were a whole bunch of games that came out that were doing aggressive extraction and were making more money than Clash of Clans. But then slowly but surely, Clash of Clans just rose and rose and rose in the charts. And eventually, they released a feature in their game called Clan Wars, where suddenly the revenue just shot up and it stayed way up. And it kept going, stayed up there for a long, long time. And this would be if the physical reality of these games was that people are all gonna leave after, you know, a certain amount of time, you gotta extract revenue as fast as possible. Unless they had gotten a ton of new installs, there's no way the revenue would have stayed up. But they didn't get a ton of new installs. And so it was really, oh wait, what did they do? What could it be? They made the game better. They made the game more fun. And people went, what?
Games and fun?
And so, you know, of course you flash forward and you look back at the games that were on the charts back then and the games that are in the charts now, and their games are still on the charts, and a bunch of the other games that were there at the time are all gone because they alienated their customers, because they were, you know, saying, okay, I'm going to sell you 1,000 power for $100 and I'm going to get used to that. Oh, how about if I sell you 2,000 power for $100? Now you're going to snap that up. But now you've gotten used to 2,000 power, I'm going to sell you 4,000 power for $100, right? And so they would just start like cranking their users for money, and eventually the users are like, this isn't fun. I don't want to buy more power. Leave me alone. Users would all go out of the game, whereas the brilliant minds at Supercell, they just kept making their game better and better and more fun and more fun. And so, you know, what's changed over the years now is this recognition that if you want to succeed in free to play, and there's been many examples, not just Clash of Clans, but the games that have lasted for forever are the games that make a deep connection with their players, make it incredibly fun, make it actually fun to spend money, which is a thing that a lot of game makers don't think about or understand, and I'm happy to touch on that. And you know, are consistently investing in making sure that the experience for the player is improved over time. And those are the folks who've essentially won over time. And so that's changed very deeply how we think about the market, about making great, you know, games that will succeed in free to play.
That's really interesting, that term, because, I mean, earlier, and this is not to sort of put you on the spot or anything, because
please
we're, do. But I mean, you attach the idea of morality to giving away something for free, so you actually attach morals to money when, rather than actually about what the intent of the game would be, other than potentially just becoming a fun thing to potentially also waste time with. Yeah. I mean, you are giving away this free candy to people in third world countries who I had this experience, you know, when I was working on The Last Worker. At some point, I wanted to get the Instagram account for just at The Last Worker, and it turned out that there was a guy in India who actually owned that name. But he had zero friends and hadn't posted anything for 4 years since he had reserved it. And I was like, God damn, I really want to have that account, you know, because it's like, I've got it on Twitter and everywhere else and whatever. So I, but there was one person that followed him. And that person, I thought maybe that person then knows this guy. And because there was no way to DM the person, right, through there. And so I contacted them, but their DMs were open. So I'm like, hey, do you happen to know this person that owns The Last Worker? So I'd like to see if I could acquire this Instagram account from them. And eventually that person responds, yeah, I know the guy actually. Can you ask him if he might be open to, you know, relinquishing his account for me? And he came back, and at first he wanted to have, you know, I think $200 or something for it, you know, for the name. And I was like, yeah, I mean, okay, this would be a good tool to have. And so, yeah, sure, that makes sense, the marketing budget. And suddenly he wanted to have $400. And after we'd agreed to this price, and I'm like, are you okay over there? Like, you know, and he goes like, I was just imagining, because, you know, this is how we project meaning on things. He was in India, I thought he suddenly felt that he could have more money because it's a video game and it sounds good, whatever. So you want to have more money out of me, and ask him like, I just don't have an infinite budget. I don't, because it's an indie, and I haven't paid myself in years on this bloody game. But so why do you want that money? I mean, I didn't ask him why he wants money. He told me himself, he said, I need to buy an iPhone. And so for him, it was the most important thing was to get an iPhone. And he told me that he was actually struggling financially, that he couldn't, he could barely buy food and all those things. But the priority was to get the phone. And you go, wow. You know, I mean, to us, it's like, yeah, we get the phone on top of all the stuff that we already have. And of course, we use it for work on whatever. But he would rather have the phone than food. Why is that happening?
Oh, well, I'm not an expert in the economy of India. I would first ask whether it isn't possible that having that phone might open up greater opportunity for him than not having that phone, whereas eating today will not do that particularly. And so there might be a lot of opportunity that he gets by having an iPhone, right? Including the ability to say, you know, drive Uber or maybe do jobs. This is where my lack of expertise comes in. I don't know what those opportunities are.
But he had an iPhone. He just had the model from 2 years ago.
Well, now that you dropped new information on me, haven't you? I don't know the answer. I don't know the answer. I think the reason why you're asking me this is it is our giving these games away for free sort of contributing into a empty consumer culture in which you got to have the new flashy thing, you got to be playing the new flashy game that everybody's playing, et cetera, et cetera. And I would say to you that I attached the word moral into what I was saying in perhaps a defensive manner.
In
comparison to what I understand to be the general impression of mobile free-to-play from my brothers and sisters in the video game industry who don't make mobile free-to-play games, which is that we are the immoral ones. Right, because we do microtransactions, and you are the moral one because you make art that you sell people for a price point up front, right? And that is what I was responding to with the moral. Now, if you're going to ask me, is late stage capitalism moral? I would say to you that we know that the answer to that is no. We know that capitalism dehumanizes. So, you know, am I a fan of dehumanizing capitalism? I am not any more of a fan of it than I am of oxygen, which I must breathe in order to live. It's what I live in.
But you might as well treat something that's profoundly wrong as the natural element that you swim in.
What does it look like for me not to be in it?
No, I mean, my challenge to this is, like, why should you set the broken, ill body that we're all currently inhabiting as the sort of normal out of which you want to rise as one of the winners?
Do I want to, or is it the nature of reality as I understand it?
Well, is it the nature of, is any of our nature to expand at infinitum, which is what mobile game corporations seem to seek?
Right. Okay. So now you've hit on the core for me, which is when you decide that all that matters to you is improving the metrics and growing the revenue.
Right. Progress
is the endless expansion of what you're doing, irrespective of the impact it has on the people who are making the game, which is probably the most common and frontline problem for people who do what I do, or the impact that it has on your players. Yes, now we get into what I consider serious moral problems, because that is directly in my control. I cannot dismantle late-stage capitalism directly, but I can absolutely decide I'm going to tell people you have to crunch or you lose your job, or I can decide I'm not going to tell people you have to crunch or lose your job. I can decide I'm going to make sure I work at a place where people share in the success of the games that they make, or I can decide I'm not going to do that. I'm going to keep it all for myself. And I think I have endeavored very hard in my career to be on what I view to be the right side of those questions. The question of whether or not is wrong to give a free-to-play game, or probably more importantly, based on what people think is really the issue, whether it's wrong to enable somebody to spend $10,000 on a free-to-play game, $50,000 on a free-to-play game, $1 million on a free-to-play game, right? I've seen all of these things. Right? Is that morally wrong? That to me is a lovely debate, and where you and I will probably end up disagreeing. And in my view, it is not wrong, and it's not wrong because I've met these people, or we talk to these people, et cetera. I think many people have the impression that the people who are doing that in games, I actually heard that from somebody at the conference, they're kids who are being tricked into spend money in these games. That is not true, right? I've worked at companies where we've worked very hard to make sure that is not true, right? They are people who have money, who really love these games, and they really like spending the money on these games. And so I would say if you and everybody at this conference inquisits their Steam habit and how much money they've spent over their lifetime on Steam, or you talk to somebody who's a very competitive Magic the Gathering player and ask them how much money they've spent over their lifetime on Magic the Gathering, that is considered completely fine and moral. But on one of these microtransactions-based games, it's considered not. And we've talked to these players. We understand that this is a source of their daily joy. They've got communities that they're talking to. They enjoy these games, et cetera. And so I don't find that to be inherently any more immoral than any other sort of commercial activity. But your mileage may vary.
Are you suggesting that there are no issues of addiction that crop up in games like this?
I think that there are issues of addiction that crop up in all video games, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, that's very clear. And there are game mechanics that seek to inherently tap into that addiction that are, this very, not necessarily great, right? So some of them are, for instance, the way you can use gacha in such a way that basically you're trying to get somebody to just endlessly purchase gacha, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you play our game Marvel Strike Force, we capped the number of various things you could buy a day, right? Which is actually the habit that the folks in the in Korea who kind of invented a lot of free-to-play got into because they realized it was actually, it's just very bad for their players. It's bad for, like, this ability to try to extract as much revenue as possible.
The pipeline,
right, is actually, it's bad. It may very well be bad morally, but it's definitely bad for the business. So you don't do it, right? You try to make sure that you actually don't lean into somebody's, even if somebody has a desire to just like keep pressing that button and keep spending the money, like you gotta actually stop that.
Sir, is this something that all the games that you've worked on kind of had stop gaps for?
I'm trying to think of what, I cannot say that all of the games I've worked on have stopgaps for that because I've worked across a lot of games. Mm-hmm. The biggest hit games that I've worked on or with teams that I've worked on do not have sort of infinite amount of purchasing on any given day, right? Because it is that is considered the best practice. But I could easily find that there's a game that has ever crossed one of the companies I've worked at that did not do that, right?
But what's interesting is, like, again, we are tying morals to money.
Yes.
We keep circling back to it.
Yes.
Because it seems to me that mobile games are very much working and operating like banking. Because it's ultimately all about money. Like in your industry, we're all the same industry technically, but again, we've created this artificial wall between us, is when you go to a mobile game conference, all they talk about is metrics and numbers and graphs, etc. Whereas in this industry, we're like, oh, no, we don't care about that. Of course we care about that.
Yes.
But we just keep that stuff to ourselves. It's not that it's dirty. It's just with the business people that aren't as cool, do back in the office while we pretend to be artists. But
they're talking about metrics.
Exactly.
So I guarantee you somebody selling your indie games is talking about metrics.
Oh my God, that's all they talk about. Pretend to make art. But so maybe what you're doing is more honest. But the thing that is interesting to me is that the other currency that's very important, and actually Chantal really hit upon that, as did I actually in my keynote here at Reboot, is that the other very important currency that we all seem to be in very, very finite, numbers, have in finite numbers, is time.
Yes.
You know, we are taking up a huge amount of time.
Yes.
And mobile games are far more intent on using up a huge amount of people's time and attention than they are more designed around that. I think it's because there's lots of single player games.
Yes.
There are, like, in consoles and PC, which do extremely well. Like, those games don't generally fare well in mobile space. In mobile space, you win when you take people's time.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
And do we not have a moral obligation to then also fill that time with value other than just fun and a waste thereof? The time, I mean.
Oh, wow. I do not believe that it is that I am a godlike being who has accountability or responsibility for how you spend your time in your life. So when you say I'm taking your time, when you say I have responsibility for how I fill your time, there I think I disagree with you. And I don't believe that the way that these games work is that we basically chain you to the game and say you must play, and people choose to play or they choose not to play, and so that's very different to me.
But that's exactly what my drug dealer friend said in Los Angeles when he was selling weed. He's like, I'm not responsible for whether someone gets addicted to this or not. This is, why should I make a moral judgment of whether this person knows how to take recreational drugs or not?
But do you think it's fair to liken playing a video game in which you're connecting with other people and enjoying yourself to drug dealing?
Are you connecting with other people when you're playing most of these mobile games?
Yeah. Most of them. Most of them have a social component. The biggest ones are social in some way. but the more sort of core ones generally are built around a team mechanic where you're playing with other people in some meaningful way, though generally asynchronously in mobile. But I have a lot of thoughts about what you're asking me, and by the way, I think it's a fair question. I don't think you're being a jerk, which is unusual for
you. He's usually a jerk.
So a thing that I learned early in free-to-play, and Chantal gave a talk earlier, which I'd ask you to set up pretty well, so I can springboard off it, which is the peach and the cake. Can you explain the peach and the cake problem?
Oh, goodness. All right. Quick little philosophy dip here. Determinism and free will. Free will is the concept that we can do anything we want at any moment. We have the choice to do it. Determinism, on the other hand, suggests that everything we do is predetermined, that we don't really have control over what we do because of predetermined circumstances. So imagine you're going down a cafeteria line. You get up to the dessert counter. The person at the cafeteria asks you, would you like the peach or would you like the cake? You stop, you think, I'm going to ask you, do you want the peach right now or do you want the cake?
Who wants the peach? Hands up. All right.
This being a live podcast, we now have actual bodies and the audience raising their hands, dear listener.
Damn. And again, most of them want the peach, these madmen. Yes. We have quite the healthy industry. I know the games industry is quite famous for its good, healthy choices. We had about two cakes. So the question then becomes, say you chose the peach. What would it have taken for you in that exact moment of choosing to make the other choice? If you chose the peach, what would it have taken in that split second of decision with no other factor, influence, piece of information changing for you to change and choose the cake instead of peach?
So that's the cake and peach problem.
No hands have gone up to answer this question, dear listener. Is there an answer, Chantal, actually, to this one?
There's debate. I mean, it's philosophy. There's no answer. There's no reality.
Yeah, but this is like, listen, we're talking about mobile games here. There must be one menu you can click.
it's a yes or no question. Cancel.
Would you fundamentally have to be the change? You would have to be a different person in that moment in order to make that different decision?
I mean, where I land is that, I couldn't solve it. I couldn't break the conundrum. I couldn't figure out how I could choose cake rather than peach without having an external factor influencing it in that moment. But in the moment of choice, no external factor does influence me. So I was kind of like, oh, fuck.
So let me explain why I wanted you to bring that up. So that's the philosophical problem. There is a field called behavioral economics that is also focused on these questions. And there's a great book that anybody can read about it by Thaler and Sunstein called Nudge. And it's about this question where we believe I chose the cake because I am a cake lover, or I chose the peach because I'm a very healthy person, I love peaches. But when we study it, we learn that most of that decision is made for us based on the position of where the peach was or where the cake was, where if you just changed up, you randomized the store, people will choose the thing that's in this position more often, etc. So that there's all these factors that go into people's choices that have nothing to do with their inherent condition or morality or anything. So they posit something, which I just love the name of, which is libertarian paternalism.
Shit.
I thought you'd really enjoy this. So they posit the idea of libertarian paternalism, which is that once you know that people make choices for reasons outside of their own, like, assumed reason, you now have potentially a moral obligation to architect choices so that they will make the choice that is better for them. You have a moral obligation to put the peach in such a way that they are more likely to choose the peach than to choose the cake. And that you can do that, and that is part of it. But they still have, that's the libertarian part, they still have the absolute freedom to choose the cake if they want to choose the cake. But you've done your part to sort of drive them towards the better choices. So I bring all this up in answer to your question. This book has been used in both directions. And the ideas of behavioral economics have been used in both directions. I know now that I can, by manipulating colors and positioning, et cetera, get you to do the thing you don't want to do that's going to give me goodies, right? Or I can do it to actually try to make this experience better for you in the way that I believe something is better for you, which is that you maybe don't spend money today. I will do things like put up a pop-up box that says, are you sure? You sure you want to spend real money on that? Right? Which is something that we do in many of our games, right? I can do things to actually change your choices to try to make sure that if you're doing it, it's because you really wanted to do it. And so this is a book that we're running out of time, but this is a book that I think goes deeply into what you're asking me.
We are running out of time. Everyone seems to be running out of it.
All dying.
What I love is that we are seeing here the beginnings of, I think, us attaching morality to time. And attaching intent to time, and the way that we use it up, the way we take it away from people. Yes, we give them something in return, but is it meaningful enough to fill their time with something that will indeed improve their lives?
Is escapism enough? Is allowing them to come away for a moment from their lives? Like, do we think that that is enough of a value return? That is a really important question to be asking, because I think if you go onto the mobile game store, you will generally find things that are really good at taking our time and really good at escapism and allowing us to forget for a moment where we are and all the crap we're dealing with today. And that all sounds really lovely until we realize that every game on the store, or most of them, look like that. And maybe this is a moment in which we should really be asking, is there more we can be doing? Can we provide that escapism while still providing something of meaning that they can take forward in their lives when they stop escaping from their life and actually return to their life? Can we as game makers, can mobile game makers actually bring moral meaning into the games we're making so that actually in exchange for time and in exchange for money, we're providing something of value that goes beyond simply hiding from the world?
I'm really excited knowing that people like Aaron Loeb make mobile games and think about where they're going, because Aaron is a deeply moral being, and because you think about philosophy and you think about humans and human rights and all those things, and you're about to take time off from the hamster wheel of corporate leadership, and I personally cannot wait to see where you take this industry next, and perhaps we can even do something together.
Thank you. I also can't wait, and you, as you know, you'll be the first to hear it.
Thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much, and thank you to the audience for being here.
Thank you all.
Directional is hosted by Jörg Tittel in London, Chantal Ryan in Adelaide, and produced by Paul Bennin in Los Angeles for Rapid Iron Withers. The theme song was composed by Oliver Krauss and Frally Hines. Follow us on Twitter @directionalshow and listen to past episodes at directional.show. See you next time.